So welcome our new people and returning people. This course, it's been a 10-week course, foundation course, and each topic each night is a standalone topic. So you'll be fine with just tonight if that's your first time here. So what we've already covered, my attempt to cover the entire Buddhist path in 10 classes or less. So, the whole course really came about from people's questions and also from my own experience of feeling really quite lost and not understanding some really fundamental things. And so that's what I tried to put into this course. All the things that are like, oh, I wish I had have known that earlier. So I tried to put all of those things in there. So we've already looked at what Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are, the Buddhist refuge. About a little bit about meditation and how meditation is caring for the mind, a little bit about the mind, the nature of our mind, being a being by nature pure, clear, and then, well, how about all the impurities in the mind, disturbing emotions, karmic imprints that follow us from life to life. What happens at that transition from this life to next life during the death process? And then the last couple of weeks, we've been looking at bodhicitta and emptiness. So, bodhicitta, the really big-hearted attitude, the wish to become a Buddha to benefit every single living being without exception. And then last week, the nature of reality. The two sides of the same coin. Does anyone remember what those two sides were of the coin? In your own words is fine. It'll come to you.
It's hiding.
It's hiding. So on one side, conventional reality. And the term was dependent arising, because it all depends on other things, dependent arising. And because of dependent arising, therefore, things are empty of inherent existence or empty of being real and true. So, emptiness is a term that we will often come across and can do your head in, as you probably found last week. And yeah, how did you go? What questions came up from it? Anything? So many? Oh, that's okay. The fact that you're trying to understand it in one night is really sweet, you know, because this is the whole reason we're still in samsara is because this is so tricky that things don't exist in the way they first appear. And everything that comes from that grasping at the appearances as being real, all of that, all the problems that come from that, that's why we're still struggling. So don't try and get it in one night. But you can feel really happy about being introduced to this because this really is the key. So the homework last week was ha to think about how do I interpret myself. So did anyone think about that? Have a doubt or a question about it? Okay, so that's a good sign. More confused about yourself now than 10 weeks ago is good because it's shifting things. Yes. Yep.
It's not always
No, it's not always comfortable, but this week, because of that shift and that flexibility, we can see, well, how's the best way to interpret ourselves? And that is the tantric perspective. So has anyone heard this word tantra? Not Californian tantra.
That's the only one I've heard.
Yeah, no, that's right. So the tantric perspective, actually, from the Buddhist Tantra takes this tendency to interpret ourselves that we have, this way of that we interpret ourselves without even knowing it, how we present ourselves or interpret ourselves, and takes this tendency and uses it to propel ourselves to enlightenment. If we want to look at what's the most effective way to interpret ourselves, it's in this tantric perspective. And then that way, we can become a Buddha incredibly quickly to benefit others. So we're going to have a look at what this perspective, how it works, what it is. Also a little bit about the power of mantras, because we're all probably familiar with mantras or chanting and things, and there is a lot to it. It's not just kind of a quaint kind of hippie thing to do. It's a very powerful practice. And yes, so Tantra is often called the lightning vehicle, a method to transform ourselves into a Buddha in just one lifetime. So, and actually, if you really go for it, you could possibly become a Buddha in like 3 to 4 years. So it takes a huge amount of dedication, but like I've said before in classes, you look at the dedication that people put into the Olympics. If you put the same amount of dedication, and instead of being motivated to be in this competitive way the best in the world, if you put the same amount of effort and motivation into becoming a Buddha, because you cannot bear that everybody is suffering, then it's possible to actually do in this lifetime. And if not become a Buddha, at least get quite substantially there. So a lightning vehicle, lightning fast. But as with all lightning fast vehicles, you have to know how to drive it. Just like a racing car, you've got to be very good at it. So there's a lot of preparation behind. Let's do our motivation for tonight. Settling your posture. Sitting well back in the chair so your lower back feels supported. Imagining fine thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, out the crown of your head, just being gently pulled upwards. Feel the weight of your body supported by this thread of light. And let your shoulders drop and any tension fall away from the shoulders. And bring your focus to the breath. Be aware of the rising and falling of the breath. And while allowing yourself to relax, then also keeping your mind alert, feeling ready to engage in the class. And our motivation for ourselves to become free of all of our disturbing emotions and become free of the cycle of suffering, to become liberated from that. And our motivation for others that by working on our own mind, we'll be able to effectively help others. And may we be able to help them in the best possible way. Especially if you get overwhelmed by the news, thinking about all the terrible things happening in the world, instead of being demoralized, having the courage to look at this suffering and think, may I be the one to be able to do something about this? And we can do so by starting right here with ourselves and expanding our motivation to encompass all living beings like ripples on a pond. Okay, so with this kind of motivation to awaken our Buddha nature. So the tantric perspective, this is actually the street I lived on in Melbourne, painted by a great Tungka painter who lives in the Blue Mountains. The tantric perspective is about acting, speaking, and thinking now as if we were already a Buddha. So what it is taking this future result that we want and then acting as if we're already enlightened. So we might think that we're pretending But actually, we're already pretending. We're pretending to be grown-ups, polite, together, intelligent, all of those things. And we're presenting this kind of way of being that we want people to believe that we're like. A lot of that may not actually be based on any kind of reality at all, but the fact that because our mind is naturally pure means that it is possible for us to become enlightened. So why not start acting like that now to hurry it along? So it's kind of like we've heard this term before, fake it till you make it. Or you know how you dress for the job that you want, isn't it? You might not actually feel confident on the inside, but you act it out and then you kind of step into the role. So if we take that to its nth degree, we could think, what would Buddha do? What would Chen Rezig do? And then start acting like that. What would the Dalai Lama do? And start pretending to be the Dalai Lama. And how we act would profoundly change. So instead of believing the limited concepts that we have of ourselves, and often we get really down about ourselves, I'm too old, or I'm too stupid, or I don't understand this or that, or I can't, or all these things that we've been told. Instead of believing all of that, starting to actually draw forth our good qualities. So, for instance, if you think I'm going to be just like Chen Rezig over here, thousand-armed Chen Rezig, Buddha of compassion, you're going to spend the whole day trying to be just like Chen Rezig with your thousand arms of compassion, with the thousand eyes that see everybody and care about everybody. So then you're going to go through the supermarket and the traffic and you're going to be embracing everybody with your thousand arms of compassion. So you're not going to be speaking badly. You're not going to be thinking badly about them. You're going to be thinking warm, loving kindness and compassion. Or your thoughts will be positive, then how you act will be positive. It makes it less likely that you'd have road rage. And so because all of that's positive, then it makes it less likely that you'll act badly. And so then you won't make any more negative karma. So it has this incredible flow-on effect. And so what we do from the tantric perspective is practice in this way of seeing ourselves as a Buddha and everybody else as a Buddha and the entire environment as a pure land. So having this pure view until it becomes our primary identification. And this is kind of the opposite of what we normally do, because what we normally do, we're hardwired biologically to look at the faults of people and to immediately spot dangers or things that are wrong. Or we're hardwired to remember all the mistakes that we've made, all the card games that we lost. We hardly ever remember anything that we won or that went well. The things that didn't go well, they stick. And that's a biological imperative because it's kept us alive, but doesn't get us enlightened. So what if you just focused on all of the positive things? It takes some effort and bring them forth. So part of this is that we do it in meditation and or imagination. And as we know, our nervous system can't tell the difference between what's a fantasy and what's reality. Like when we go to the movies, we go to the horror show or whatever. Or even a funny movie, you have a physiological response even though we know it's fantasy. So the tantric perspective of all the meditations on Chen Rezig or Amitabha or Tara, all of those things, is a way of actually changing our whole experience. So it's not just intellectual. It's a whole lived, felt experience. And so that changes us. You could go so far as saying it even changes the neural pathways in our brain, the way that we respond. So the other thing about the tantric perspective is when we're talking about Buddhist tantra, Buddha taught Tantra on the basis of Lam Rim. So tantric practices aren't just exclusive to Buddhism or California. There's Hindu Tantra, which is what this Buddhist Tantra came out of, that that system. There's also some tantric practices in Sufi tradition, in Jewish mysticism. So it's quite across the board, but very esoteric. The Buddha taught Tantra on the basis of Lam Rim, meaning on this, in a word, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the view of emptiness. So that's what makes it Buddhist. So Tantra, not to reach the pinnacle of samsara, not to have great sex, not to become a world-dominating king. The sole purpose is to become a Buddha for the benefit of all. That's the what the basis that it's taught on. So in a nutshell, Lam Rim, renunciation, bodhicitta, and the view, correct view. Now, Lama Yeshe has this wonderful way of describing it. So we will go into in a moment, but of course with tantric practice, it was originally secret, mainly because it's just like, for instance, getting a chemistry set. If you get a chemistry set and you play around in the kitchen and you go, oh, I wonder what's going to happen here or happen there, like it's going to work whether you understand it or not, and you could blow up the kitchen. So you need to have all the checks and balances and the training in place first, or things can go really horribly wrong. But once you do have that in place by having initiation and getting instruction, then the whole chemistry set will work. Okay, so this is what Lama Yeshe says. Generating the divine pride of being the deity is very important. Say, for instance, of being Chenrezig. Our normal tendency is to feel dissatisfied and to criticize our body, speech, and mind. My body's out of shape, my voice is unpleasant, my mind is confused. We are so caught up in this pointless neurotic habit of criticism that we disparage others as well as ourselves. And from the tantric point of view, this is extremely damaging. The way to counter this tendency is to cultivate a sense of divine pride, the strong feeling when entering the Nirmanakaya experience that you are the actual fully enlightened emanation body of a Buddha, that your mind is completely free of all superstitions and limitations. Otherwise, if you continue to hold on to the idea that you're basically confused and angry, you will manifest as a confused and angry person, and certainly not as a blissful deity. You can stop this destructive way of thinking about yourself and avoid the negative self-defeating consequences by concentrating on the oneness of your own fundamental consciousness and the wise, compassionate qualities of the guru deity. In this way, you open yourself up to the great waves of inspiration that can transform your life completely. The more intensely you concentrate on this feeling of divine pride, the more profoundly will you experience freedom from all forms of limitation and satisfaction. You should also practice seeing all appearances as illusory, lacking concreteness as something out there separate from your mind. In other words, you should recognize all appearances as arising from emptiness, as having the very nature of emptiness, of non-duality. And finally, your experience of empty, illusory appearance should be of an exceedingly blissful nature. So that's the tantric perspective. So that's why last week when we talked about emptiness, it sets the scene for this. So in a way, the tantric perspective is like applied emptiness. If we have this understanding of emptiness, then how do we be in the world? The very best possible way. Okay, questions, random questions. Come on. Yeah, Amanda. Adam bombed you into delusions.
Last week?
Yes.
In the senses,
the implications of emptiness, of not being, you know, things not being inherently true, the implications are mind-blowing. They are like an atom bomb. That's right. Yep. Yep. And so then the how to work with that, there's got to be a way that we work with it. So this is a very creative and effective way of working with it. So it's really different from just make-believe, because make-believe is kind of like you're thinking this is me and now I'm going to pretend to be something else. But actually all of the tantric practices start by dissolving into emptiness, by that meditation on emptiness. So you get, and then out of emptiness you arise as the deity. So we do a similar thing on Sundays with the meditation on the Buddha. We have the purification from the Buddha, and then the Buddha melts into light and into us, and then we dissolve into light, and then through the power of our compassion arise as the Buddha, and then we say the mantra again. So it's exactly the same process. You dissolve your ordinary sense of who you are, really enjoy that experience of emptiness, and then through the power of your bodhicitta, your great loving kindness and compassion, you arise as the deity. Some deity. So I've been talking a lot about Chenrezig Compassion Buddha. He's another beautiful image. So all of the deities, you think they're in a like a rainbow bubble made of light. So that's to remind you that they're in the nature of emptiness. Anything where it's light, it means by nature empty, radiant, luminous. And when we look at all of these images, it's nice to think, including with the Buddha, it's nice to think that it's like a mirror of your potential. You think of it as a mirror. The very fact that you can relate to it in any way is a mirror of your potential. And what we do, because we are alienated from all of these qualities within us, we've got to put the image out there to start with and then build this connection and then arise as the deity, dissolve all into emptiness and rise as the deity. So each of the deities are like a embodiment or a manifestation of different enlightened qualities. So Thousand Arm Chenrezig is a manifestation of great compassion. And so instead of me handing you a list about great compassion, it's a bit dry, isn't it? You have an image, you have a really beautiful image that's like the personification of it. So I do my Chenrezig practice at the gym. Especially there's a thing that you've got to pull like this. Don't know what it's called. Anyways, oh my God. So then I dissolve in emptiness and I rise as Thousand Arm Chenrezig, and I have my thousand arms. I'm like, I'm gonna embrace all sentient beings, loving kindness and compassion. It's so awesome. So I say, one Om Mani Padme Hum, two Om Mani Padme Hum, three Om Mani Padme Hum. It's so good. And so then I figure, okay, this is all of my kind of recalcitrant negative emotions that's hard. So, yeah, it is hard to push on through it. But there's something really amazing about having the momentum of doing this. And so then depending who I'm not getting on with that week, I have them right there in front of me and I give them great big huge Chenrezig hugs. So you're very lucky if you're one of my enemies, right? Because it's just laid on its face, all this. And so it totally transforms my mind. So I end up feeling really close to the people that I don't get on with. I feel really close to them because I've been, instead of kind of focusing on everything that's gone wrong, I've been focusing on just trying to be compassionate. Well, you know what did it was because I got really, really upset and I'm like, I'll do anything. And because it really changes your mind. Doing these practices really does change your mind. So Thousand Arm Chenrezig, then there's another one here. This is a depiction of Vajrasattva, the Buddha of purification. So Vajrasattva is holding a bell in his lap and a doji at his heart. And so this represents non-duality, the unification of method and wisdom, and the white, the purification. So a lot of the Buddhist deities are very peaceful, blissful looking. And then there are some that you might find are quite scary looking. So here's six arm Mahakala. Some of you might have seen images like this as well. In one of the articles I read, it's like being hulked up. Which I think is a really good way of putting it. And so this is, so Mahakala is actually a manifestation of compassion, but like fierce compassion. So it's like when the delusions get really, really strong, you've got to have an equally strong, compassionate counterforce. It's like with bullies. You have to be strong. You can't be weak. But it's not strong as in retaliating. It's like it's fierce care. And so when the delusions come up, the self-grasping comes up, the self-cherishing, all of that, then Chenrezig manifests as Mahakala and conquers those delusions so that we're free of them. So, yeah, the scarier the better, because who's it scaring? It's scaring the delusions, scaring away those distorted, destructive states of mind. Often in temples, these kind of images are behind the curtains, just so that when people come in, like here, you know, here we are in Brisbane, people don't think, oh, a bunch of devil worshippers. You know, I mean, even at the front of a temple, we're supposed to have the 12 links of dependent arising, because it's got the whole path to enlightenment there, but it's held by what looks like a demon with these, you know, teeth and claws, but it's impermanence. And as ordinary beings, that's how we experience impermanence. It's frightening. Anyway, I'm thinking if we put one of those on our front door, it's just not going to, so we do have a little one, but I didn't. So then Lama Zopa Rinpoche said it'd be really good to have a monk there that just explains it every time someone walks in. Yes, it would. And I thought, oh, maybe we could get like a cardboard cutout of a monk with a speech bubble, or a cardboard cutout of a monk with a QR code, and then you can click on it and ta-da, here's the path to enlightenment, and then get it explained. But anyway, so There's a couple of images of the back here of wrathful deities, but that's what it's about. It's still compassion. It's still utterly to help others. Ariyatara, Green Tara. Green Tara is also the tanka behind here. Buddha of compassionate action, help in emergencies. So she's depicted with one of her feet stepping out. So that kind of shows that she's already come to your help even before you've asked. You know, quick help in emergencies. So what happens? You know, I pray to Tara a lot to help me with Lungri Tungpa Center and things, because I'm not so good at organizing, right? So I really do try, but sometimes it's like despite myself, and Tara just steps in and helps. And so in a way, it's kind of like most of the time we go through our life quite disassociated from our qualities. We kind of need other people to recognize that we have them. So a lot of these practices, you pray to Chenrezig or to Tara as a way of establishing a connection with that like universal energy. And then when you pray to them, you've established that connection. So then it wakes up. It wakes up in you, but it also just wakes up in the universe. So then any kind of help that's going to come has a way to come and help you. So it's not like just like praying to some God, hey, please help me. Like it's much more kind of effective than that if you understand what's going on. But it also means that when you're really desperate, you just naturally pray. Like you're just like, help. Even if you don't know who you're praying to. So when you're like that, praying to Tara is who you pray to, Mother Tara. Then Manjushri, golden Manjushri with a sword. So what do you reckon the sword's for? Cutting the root of ignorance. That's right. Whoosh, in one go. The flaming sword of wisdom. There's many other deities. Someone asked me once, how can you tell who's who? Well, it's kind of like if you had a really big family photo. How can you tell who's who? You could tell it's your family. okay, questions, comments? Oh, the Chitty Patty couple, yes. The Kinkara couple, the dancing skeletons. Yeah, so they're a form of protectors. They're my favourite. Yes. Yep, so there's all sorts of wonderful stories about them. They are two great practitioners as well, and they're in the retinue of Vajrayogini. Yep. And they're actually, I mean, they're actually in a pure land that's just full of houses made of bones and sinews and all sorts of things. It looks like candy, red and white candy, and dancing skeletons everywhere. Yeah, so... In a lot of the depictions, like with Chenrezig, that you see the Bodhisattva crown, and they often have five jewels in the crown, and it represents the five kind of the five aggregates that make up a person transformed into the five wisdoms, into a Buddha. And then in the wrathful ones, instead of five jewels, they have five skulls, but it still represents the same thing. It's just a different flavor. Yeah. The rainbow stockings represent the rainbow body. Yeah. And then all of the robes are kind of wafting, like with a smoke machine, wind machine, you know, but that's through the power of the realizations. All right. So there's a way that we can describe the tantric approach or the tantric path, what makes it really unique within Tibetan Buddhism. I think, there's very few, you know, traditions left other than in Tibetan Buddhism where the tantric practice will bring you to enlightenment. So one is that it's called secret. And this is because it is like a bit of a chemistry set. It's secret not because it's some kind of secret club, but to protect you so that you don't get to do all of those practices before you've had the initiation, before you've got your license. So you can't just like be a merry little six-year-old and get in a car and start driving really fast around everywhere, because you are going to be driving really fast around everywhere. So it's secret until you find a qualified practitioner who is qualified to give the initiation, and then you receive the initiation and you take vows. So the vows keep you safe, and those vows are like the vows of altruism, so that you don't ever get off onto delusions of grandeur of like, hey, everybody do what I say because I'm Chenrezig. You have all of these vows to keep your heart pure and your conduct pure. So you become someone, a suitable vessel to receive this initiation and do this practice. So you can't just practice from reading from a book. It's kind of like how, you know, they don't like putting all of the recipes for making bombs on the internet, because maybe you do need to blow up something, blow up a bit of earth to create something, but you don't want everybody knowing how to make bombs. So to be able to actually dissolve into emptiness and arise as the deity, you need to have an initiation. But everybody can say the mantras, and everybody can share in the pujas and the meditations by just having Tara or Chenrezig in front. That's perfectly okay. So the next one, the next unique quality out of these six names of Tantra is mantra. So mantra means mind protection. So what do you think we're protecting the mind from? Delusions? All of those, but it's a particular thing. So I've tried to pull up the veil of ordinary appearances. So what we're protecting the mind from is this ordinary reductionist way of living. this very limited way of viewing ourselves and others and the world, ordinary conceptions and perceptions. If we're protected from the ordinariness, then we're not going to act ordinary. If we're not acting ordinary, we're not going to be making any negative karma. We're already protected. So mind protection. And I think, you know, with the great lamas and practitioners, this is why we feel so nice in their presence, because they're not seeing us as limited beings. They're gazing at us with great loving kindness as potential Buddhas, probably actually just like a Buddha doesn't see sentient beings, sees Buddhas, so relating entirely with our Buddha potential. And so if someone's relating to us like that, we just feel good. We kind of rise to the occasion. It's called the resultant vehicle because you practice the future result now. So we still have the same goal. We still want to become a Buddha for the benefit of all, but we're just doing it in this different way. So like superheroes. Did anyone used to play superheroes? Does anyone still play superheroes? Amanda, you probably play superheroes with the kids, yeah? Yeah. So you try on all these, you know, different enlightened outfits and see how it goes. In a way, we practice the resultant vehicle in other things in life. Like if you became parents, you're practicing, you're pretending to be a perfect, wonderful parent, even though on the inside you're probably shaking in your boots. But to your kids, that's what you manifest. You manifest someone strong and safe. So we do it until it becomes a reality. It's called the Vajra vehicle. So the Vajra representing the indestructible purity of the mind. So what that shows us is that it's not that we turn into something else. It's not that you turn into Chenrezig. It's your naturally pure mind. That continuum is actually, because of its nature, can actually become Chenrezig, bring forth all those qualities. So it's not like abracadabra and you're done. It's this continuum. So this is where the non-duality comes in, that it's not that you turn into something else, but the continuum of this mind that we have, bringing forth all of its qualities, removing all of the negativities, manifesting as a Buddha. And it can happen because the nature of the mind can't be broken, can't be sullied in any way. It's indestructible. Indestructible purity. Then all the different methods, many skillful methods. So that from the tantric point of view, you can use every single experience and emotion on the path. So I'll give you an example. It's like from the sutra point of view, if we're just practicing bodhicitta, we try and practice all of these, you know, loving kindness and compassion, and negative minds come up, we put an antidote on. We get angry, we start practicing patience so that the emotions erupt and then you calm them down, you pacify. So the tantric point of view takes the energy of those emotions and it uses that energy. So it's a little bit like martial arts, you know. With martial arts, you use the energy of the aggressor. As they're coming at you, you just do a little thing and off, and then they just, and you haven't expanded any energy at all. So what you do, everything, all the emotions that come up, you use the energy of those emotions to transform your mind. So when you have, for instance, anger coming up, you have that, anger's powerful, isn't it? Anger is an energy. And it comes up. So you don't get angry at people. You use the power of anger, to destroy that, you know, aggression. Use the power of anger to destroy afflictive emotions, to destroy the self-cherishing. So instead of trying to pacify the anger, you go, well, who am I really going to be angry at? The delusions, self-grasping. Not going to let you go. So that way you get to, instead of suppressing things, you get to use everything. So it's very fast. When you have desire and craving come up, instead of following those external objects of desire, which is what we're so used to doing, we think it's the thing. Like if you get, like Chad, you were saying you've got a bit of a sweet tooth. If you just got this craving for something sweet, like you can't get it out of your head, can you? So that's because we get fixated on the external thing. But if you use that craving, you go, what is the nature of craving? What if I was craving for enlightenment? What if I was craving for wholeness, for becoming a Buddha? So then you don't have to squash down the craving. No, Miffy. No, Chad. You use it to destroy the craving. So you can also, yeah, you can use every single emotion on the path. So the practices before this are, before the tantric path is a lot of what's called thought transformation, where you start working with those emotions. Instead of trying to squish them down, you use them. So it's taking all of that emotional kind of flexibility and then using it creatively in the tantric path. So it means you've got to be really honest and, like you were saying, courageous, because it's very easy to fall off the path and get self-deluded or get up yourself. And we see it quite often that people can be great Buddhist teachers for a while, and then they get a lot of students, and then they just slip a bit. They start believing their own press. They start thinking they're really something special, more special than everybody else. So self-cherishing and self, you know, that kind of delusion starts creeping in without you knowing it. So that's why we have all those vows to keep ourselves safe from corruption. And the last one is called the Canon of the Vijadharas. So these are the great practitioners who have incredible accomplishments and have the ability to be able to extend your lifespan so you can get the job done, become enlightened. So instead of having an untimely death, or instead of getting sick early, and to be able to actually pacify disease and expand your lifespan, to be able to complete the practices. So it's a little different from everything else. How are we going? Questions, comments? Is it familiar, or is it all the first time you're hearing about this? First time? Okay. Yep. Oh, that's good. Phew. Yes, so usually the emotions are destructive because they're focused outwards towards either something that we want or something that we dislike. And we believe it. So that's called believing the appearances. So instead it's looking at the actual nature of the emotion. Because the emotion's telling us this story, which, say, in terms of anger, is you're wrong. It's your fault. So it's telling us this story of I don't want something. So instead of thinking the thing out there is the problem, it's looking at, well, where's the actual problem? Yep, yep, which is usually to do with a mistaken view of the world and ourselves. Yes. Yeah. So it's kind of like, if you're going to be angry, we've got to get it at the right target. And the right target is ignorance, self-grasping ignorance, and the self-cherishing mind. And so then you blow that bit up, then it frees it up to actually have more positive relationships.
Yeah.
And that's just in That's short term. So this the tantric perspective is like a 24-hour thing. While you're awake, while you're asleep, the whole time, while you're meditating, while you're not meditating. So mostly the practices of Tantra are focused on transforming the energy of desire, of craving and desire, and blissful energy onto the path. So it's harder. And in fact, it's easier to transform pain and anger because we have an incentive. It's very difficult to transform blissful experiences onto the path because we just go, oh, that's nice, and just become a hedonistic. And we forget to use them. Anyway, let's do a short meditation because then I've got something to really blow your mind. So this is called the 9-round breathing. So what I'd like you to do is imagine that the inside of your body is all clear. It's like you're like a nice kind of shell of a body. On the inside is clear and radiant, and there are three channels of light. One of them running in just in front of where your spine would be, up through your body, and coming curving around the inside of your skull and coming out kind of between the eyebrows. And then two side channels parallel, running from kind of just below the navel there, up either side, also curving around the inside of your skull and coming out both nostrils. And they're about the width of your little finger and made of light, very radiant. And all three of them join just below the navel. So what I'd like you to do is imagine that you're going to breathe in through the left channel. And you feel that you're breathing in radiant light, or the light of enlightenment. And this light flows through that left channel, curving around the inside of your skull, down through your body to below the navel. And then as you breathe out through the right channel. And as you do, that light pushes out all of the negativities through that tube of the right channel, the form of black smoke and soot. And it gets pushed up through that channel, curving around the crown of, around the inside of your skull and out through the right nostril. So try and feel that you're breathing through the channels as you're breathing through the nose. So three long, leisurely breaths. And then when you're ready, swapping the nostrils over and now breathing in through the right channel, feel this blissful golden light flowing up around the inside of your skull, down through that right-hand channel, crossing over below the navel. And then as you breathe out, this light pushes out all the negativities in the form of smoke through that left-hand channel. So with the sides swapped over, again, three long leisurely breaths. And then for the final three breaths, imagine that you're breathing in through both the left and right channels. You breathe in the blissful, radiant light. It flows, curving up around the inside of your skull, down through your body. And then as you breathe out through the central channel. And feel that as the light flows up through that central channel, all of the negativities and darkness is pushed up and outwards. Feel the curve of that central channel around the inside of your skull, and it exits just kind of like below, between the eyebrows, a little lower. So in through both side channels, out through the central channel, three long, leisurely breaths. And when you've completed those nine rounds, then just be aware of the radiance of those three channels. Feel that you're breathing in and out clarity, clear light. And notice if you feel any different than the beginning of the meditation, and then gently bring your focus back to the room. So there are many ways to do this nine round breathing. Sometimes it's just breathing in the radiant light and out the smoke without any channels. But actually, I find breathing through the channels really effective because I like that feeling of the light pushing out the negativities. So all of these practices that we do, the simple breathing meditations, the more detailed nine round breathing, are all precursors for actually doing tantric practices of actually purifying the subtle nervous system, all the channels within our body, and turning our physical gross body that often feels so stiff and tired and exhausted into a body of a Buddha. And so this is where we come to our psychic anatomy lesson. So those channels are actually there. And often when we get ill, it's because they get all out of kilter, stuck and tangled. And so how we have on this subtle nervous system, it's kind of on the level of, if you've ever had acupuncture, you know, acupuncture works on a subtle nervous system. When you do Tai Chi, you can feel the Chi, that's also on a subtle nervous system. So it's more, it's like we have our physiological one, we've got the blood circulation, and we've got the nerves, and we've got the nervous system, we've got the subtle nervous system. So this is on a very subtle level. So we've got the channels, which is like our psychic nervous system. And there are many, many branches of them. And it runs parallel to our physical nervous system. And it's the channels are like the vehicle for our consciousness to float all the parts of our body. So here we've just got the three central, the central channel and the two side ones, but there are like thousands of them. Just like when we've seen anatomy drawings, there's thousands even on a physical level. And then what flows, then at various parts of the body are what are called chakras. So we've heard this term before, right? So chakra actually means wheel or knot, energy knot. So actually our chakras, and there's some drawings there, crown, throat, and the heart are the main ones. They're like, at the moment, they're energy knots, or where the energy is kind of congested or concentrated. And so in meditation, if you can release those energy knots, then the energy flows freely. But you want to have, just like if you have a chemistry set, you want to have instructions. You don't want to go off on your own and experiment with this, because if you do, it will actually change your channels and chakras. And if you make a mistake, they say it's really hard to put things back in the right place. So we have the chakras, and we kind of have a sense of that, like when you get scared, you know, we feel it there. Or I know when I get really upset, I kind of feel like I'm caving in here. Also, when we get frightened, here at the navel, that solar, you know, the fear. So we have that kind of sensation. And then what flows through these channels and the chakras is what's called the winds. Wind meaning energy, movement, really subtle movement. So think of this like life force, chi or prana. And then also what is in this psychic anatomy lesson are what are called the drops. So they're not physical drops, but they're very subtle drops, which are like a coalescence of really subtle body and mind, energy and mind. And the main drop is the one called the indestructible drop at the heart. And so that, when the indestructible drop separates, that's actually when the death time happens. So, you know, the breathing might have stopped, the brain might have stopped, the circulatory system, but the indestructible drop hasn't separated yet, the final one. So the indestructible drop is like the subtle basis for our physical body. So you might think this is all kind of like kind of far-fetched and whatever. It's very subtle. And keep in mind that our whole, even in our Western tradition, they just, it was only like 4 years ago, no, 6 years ago now, they discovered a new organ in the body. Huh. Do you know? Do you know what it is? No. It's called the interstitial fluid. Oh. So it's this, it covers 80% of our body, the interstitial fluid, and it's kind of there below the skin. And it only functions when we're alive, so you can't see it in cadavers. So it took up until really recently for people to be able to actually monitor it and see it. So the interstitial fluid comes and goes, as and it's in conjunction with as our life force comes and goes. So that, you know, so it's not like, oh, anatomy, it's a done deal from the 18 whatevers or the 1700s, you know. How come we've been able to discover a whole new organ in the body that keeps us alive? Because the technology was there. So the technology of this is from the mind, from concentration and really subtle observation of what's going on in the body. So the mental technology to look at these really subtle energy systems that reside right here in our body. And so when we meditate on those, in the various, you know, quite advanced practices, that's a way that we bring forth like the rainbow body.
Yeah.
The light body of a Buddha. It's here as a potential already in our own body. How do we do all of this? Well, for all of us, the way is, the very beginning part is to do the beautiful meditations of the, you know, the light purifying oneself and others, and to recite the mantras. Really simple. So the mantras are like, they have the entire path to enlightenment in them. They're like highly condensed teachings. Everything's there. So it's worth focusing your mind on it. And I found reciting mantras are not just a matter of belief, because when I've had sick animals and I've gone there and patted them, they've still been really distressed. And the moment I've started reciting mantras, they have calmed down, immediately pacified. And same thing when my mother was dying too. She had some, you know, secondary brain tumors and things like that, and was having some like mini strokes. And one of her friends was there holding her hand. "They're there, don't worry." And I'm like, "Shut up." and nothing worked. She was still having these tremors and really agitated. And then Eddie went in and just started reciting medicine Buddha mantra, and she immediately stopped, just like that. Same calm voice. But that's the power of the mantra. There's a lot of power there. And so instead of going around with our inner ordinary mantras, like, "How very dare they? How very dare they?" or, "I really don't want to do that thing," over and over and over again. Like, what kind of inner mantras do we have? What if we had this really condensed path to enlightenment that we could focus our mind on and become one with? So this one is Om Mani Padme Hum. We're going to do a meditation on this in a moment. And so with the mantras, so it's in Tibetan, Om Mani Padme Hum. It's the mantra of compassion. And you could write a book about the meaning of Om. Mm. In fact, the book of Om Mani Padme Hum would lead you from here to Chenrezig Compassion Buddha's enlightenment. Everything's in it. So there's long explanations, middle, short, tiny, short. Om represents body, speech, and mind of a Buddha because it's got these three sounds in it, O, A, and Ma. So Om, it's got three sounds, body, speech, and mind. So from this ordinary body, speech, and mind transformed into enlightened body, speech, and mind. That's just in Om. Yeah, Amanda. And it's so much nicer to sing those rather than, like, what else do we teach our kids? Itsy Bitsy Spider. I mean, how stupid. What a waste. He's so impressionable. And what do we have? These kind of throwbacks to the plague times, as if that's like some kind of good reason for memorizing. Like, I can't understand it. So, but if you've got Om Mani Padme Hum, here it is, the path to enlightenment, to become a compassionate, loving human being. That's all you need to do in life. You don't even have to be successful. Just do that and your life is worthwhile. So then you've got the wish to attain the Buddha's, you know, enlightened body, speech, and mind. Then the Mani means the jewel, bodhicitta, compassion. And Padme, the lotus. And so the lotus is such a beautiful kind of analogy because it's like no mud, no lotus. So the lotus comes out of the mud unstained. So it represents the purity of the mind. No matter how much mud and compost wherein our mind remains unstained, unsullied. So our innate wisdom. So we've got the bodhicitta, the jewel heart, and the wisdom. And the wisdom supports the jewel of bodhicitta, the good heart. And then hum, meaning indivisibility of compassion and wisdom. So that, again, the non-duality. And tying it all together, becoming the pure, exalted body, speech, and mind of a Buddha. So then when you recite mantras, your body becomes a holy object. So the wind touches your body and touches others, they're blessed. You go swimming, all the creatures in the ocean are blessed. You recite the mantras, all the beings seen and unseen in your house are blessed. It's a way of really creating harmony. at the. It's really nice, really lovely, lovely practice. Yeah, well, especially it's better than panicking, isn't it? So at the very least, even if you're a non-believer, it doesn't matter. You're feeling better, and then you have the blessings of this, that huge amount. And then in the middle is this syllable kri. So this is called a seed syllable. And so this is my take on seed syllables. So the seed syllable for Chenrezig is kri, is like the most condensed form of compassion, enlightened compassion. And it's just like, for instance, the seed syllable for water is H2O. You know, so if you say H2O, wherever it is, in my glass of water, in our bodies, in the sky, on wherever, that's its nature. So compassion as well, whether it's in your heart or Chenrezig's heart or the Buddha's heart, it's compassion. It's not different. So the compassion in your heart, that compassion that you have, is the same as the compassion in Chenrezig's heart. By nature, it's the kri or the H2O. So before we do a meditation on this, questions? That's right, through Tibet and also in Ladakh and other Buddhist places like this, instead of advertising for Coca-Cola and Chico rolls, you've got Om Mani Padme Hum everywhere that you look. It's carved on the rocks, on the cliff face. Okay, so... So compassion benefits not only others but ourselves as well. As the Dalai Lama has said, you might have even heard this in your recent travels, if you want others to be happy, practice loving compassion. If you want yourself to be happy, practice loving compassion. We all possess the potential to be limitlessly compassionate. A powerful way of awakening and developing this potential is by visualizing Chenrezig, the embodiment of compassion, and contemplating his mantra. So let's do, you know, we've talked a lot about this. Let's have a nice little meditation on compassion and Chenrezig. So again, just settle your posture. Have a nice balance between keeping your spine straight and feeling comfortable. And so with a altruistic attitude of loving compassion, your natural wish for yourself and others to be completely free of all their sufferings, and attain the happiness they so desire, then imagine that out of the quantum field of emptiness, there arises a complete and perfect manifestation of compassion. The quintessence of compassion wherever it exists, in you, in me, in the bodhisattvas, appearing as Chenrezig. A living, light-filled embodiment of great compassion and a mirror of your own potential. So imagine Chenrezig there in the space in front of you, about at the level of your eyebrows, seated on a lotus and moon cushion of light, Chenrezig has four arms, the first two hands at his heart holding the jewel of bodhicitta. Then his other right hand holds a crystal rosary, lifting each sentient being out of suffering. And his other left hand holds a golden lotus, signifying his completely purified, the root of samsara, the concept of true existence, and holds the great wisdom directly perceiving emptiness. And there's so much energy of kindness and compassion radiating from Chenrezig that even the robes on his body are suspended slightly and wafting in the breeze of his realizations. Chenrezig's compassionate gaze encompasses you and simultaneously all sentient beings. So think of all the people that you know who are suffering, your friends, people in the news, enemies. See them all surrounding you. And a great rain of light and nectar flows from Chenrezig's heart, radiating out to you and all these sentient beings, putting out the fires of their inner turmoil and alleviating all suffering, bringing you to a state of blissful peace. So you can join in with the mantra if you feel comfortable. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Feel yourself and all beings bathed in this blissful light that washes away all of the disturbing emotions and confusions and fears. Pacifies the mind, even the environment becomes peaceful and clear. Especially all the minds of the aggressors are washed clean of their afflictions, are pacified, become blissfully peaceful, naturally kind and compassionate. And this mantra, reflecting the pure energy of compassion that exists in every living being, bringing forth this compassion in the form of light. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 And seeing that this blissful vision is entirely possible because of the clean, clear nature of our mind and the minds of every living being. Very gradually, Chen Rezig begins to melt into light. And this light melts into you, flowing down through the crown of your head, through your central channel. Coming to rest at the level of your heart, incredibly bright. And in that radiance, your mind merges with Chen Rezig's mind. Know this as your true nature. And then dedicate this meditation to being able to bring this to reality. So we do Chen Rezig meditations and other meditations on the Sunday mornings, and we have lots on our YouTube channel. So this meditation on Chen Rezig, we can bring forth this light body of Chen Rezig by doing all of these practices. With the technology of this really subtle technology working with our subtle nervous system. We've actually also met or seen on TV a manifestation of Chen Rezig, because that's what they say who His Holiness is. So what's the manifestation of great compassion? Chen Rezig, like four-armed Chen Rezig or thousand-armed Chen Rezig. But we find it difficult to relate to that, and perhaps don't have the karmic eyes to see a light being with all these arms, though some people do. But who we can see is a manifestation of Chen Rezig in human form. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Chen Rezig in person on this earth. Yeah. And it was like that with Lama Zopa Rinpoche too. I remember going to meet him at the airport, and it was like walking into this pool of calm nectar that like radiated out about 10, 15 meters from Rinpoche. And I'd noticed, because the airports are busy,
yes.
People would come running, and then they kind of reach this pool and they go, and then they get, and then they running. It was that tangible. It was incredible. So they say, Tantra, it's the lightning vehicle, right? And so if we keep practicing on the Bodhisattva path, it can take a very long time, three countless great eons. But the tantric vehicle, because it's so concentrated and uses everything on the path, the actual quote is that in one short lifetime of a being of the degenerate age, which is what we're in, from the first initial practice of Tantra until the attainment of Buddhahood. So that means, doesn't mean that you have to be even born into a Buddhist family. So for instance, my mother, Inta, who started this center, she only came across the Dharma when she was 45 years old. And she met the Lamas, Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Lama Yeshe, maybe when she was 50 years old. So it took her that long to meet the tantric path. And so then she started this center when she was about 52 years old in her lounge room. She had various initiations, did her practices as well as possible, but also did things like ate lots of cheesecake and went to the movies. And so 55, 65, she died when she was 71. So 55, 65. How many years is that? 15 years. I can't count. You know I can't count. 15 years or 25 years? 55 to 71? 16 years. There you go. 16 years. So by the time she died, really good death, took about 2.5 days before the consciousness left the body. Lama Zopa Rinpoche and His Holiness the Dalai Lama said prayers for her personally. They were on the other side of the world, but they said prayers for her. There was rainbows that manifested above the house in Newmarket. And Lama Zopa Rinpoche said she had a really good death. And so, and then, and also a couple of us, I kid you not, heard like this exquisite music. We all thought someone had left the radio on.
Yeah.
Up like in the corners of the room for that time that the body was there, but the consciousness hadn't left. The whole place was just completely transformed. Mm-hmm. So from having met the Dharma at that age of 55 and doing all of these practices and just following the instructions, she may not have become a Buddha while she was walking around doing the photocopying, but in that process, she was able to use that process to at least get somewhere there, like, really, I witnessed with my own eyes, and along the way benefited heaps of people. So it's possible. Take heart. So we have our summary. Buddha taught Tantra on the basis of the three principal aspects of the path: renunciation, represented by the lotus; bodhicitta, represented by the moon, the cooling rays of the moon; and the correct view, represented by the sun. So those three principal aspects of the path, the Lam Rim, is what keeps us from being corrupted. The whole principle of Tantra is to act now as if we're already enlightened. Yeah, well, even then in the death process, then instead of all of the hallucinations that arise, what you have is the hallucinations of the Pure Lands, of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. That's where your mind is magnetized to. Mm. And all you have to do is just open your mind like that, and they will come and help you.
Yes.
And meanwhile, in our day-to-day life, the tantric perspective protects us from ordinary appearances. And this is the biggest thing that stuffs our life up, isn't it, is underestimating people and things. And ourselves,
judging
assumptions, but mostly underestimating what we're capable of. So instead of boxing ourselves into misery and ordinariness, we can use everything that arises in our personality on the path to enlightenment, or the energy of it. So just before we dedicate, I've got a little present for everybody. If you hand this one out. So here's a picture of Shakyamuni Buddha in the middle, the historical Buddha that we have a connection with. We've met the Buddha's teachings. And then on the white Buddha is Chenrezig, compassion. And the other Buddha is Manjushri, the golden one, wisdom. So that's like the two wings of the bird, the compassion and the wisdom on either side. Because I thought, you know, we've had quite an adventure, haven't we, these 10 weeks?
Yeah.
I've had an adventure. I'm so glad I've been able to take you along on this adventure. So just before we dedicate, what we're going to – oh, where's our next – I didn't put in the what comes next. What comes next is this fantastic course called Cultivating Lasting Happiness. That's part of this series of Buddhist mind science. And so it's Buddhism with a contemporary explanation, so that it doesn't kind of just sound weirdly esoteric and over there, but how to bring it into our life. And guess who's going to lead it? Luke over here. Wave your arm, Luke. So I don't know if you've met Luke before, but... Luke was around here when Geshe Sherab was here, and Luke has actually done this course with the people that devised the course. So it's part of the FPMT, so it's a really nice lineage. I think it's so nice that they're your friends and you've got the feel of it to bring, yeah. So I'll be here next week too, and I hope all of you will, and we'll just continue on with this great adventure. And I think Luke's course is a way of then being able to start integrating what we've learnt into our life, because I've given you the structure and it's like, whoa, here's the structure of the castle. Now what?
The furniture.
The furniture. And And it's really nice because this course, the course that Luke's leading, has been out for a little while, and I've really wanted to put it on here, and I've been looking around for the person. And then it was only recently that Luke moved all the way over from Nepal to here, and so I'm trying to convince him to stay in Brisbane by tying him down to courses. Anyway, I'm sure Luke will tell you a little bit more about his life next week. Let's dedicate. Oh, Adrian, yes. I have been aware that you're there online, stalwart online. It must be quite tricky not being able to interact, but thank you for coming. So let's just think back over all the classes that we've done together and feel really happy that you've put aside the time, battled the traffic, done the internal work and the reflection and the questioning, all of this making your life truly meaningful. And how we've had our first go around the all of the essentials of the Buddhist path. We have all the ingredients. How rare and wonderful to have met the Dharma at this stage in our lives, in our chronically distracted world. So appreciate your efforts and the continuous benefit that will flow on from you attending this course, not just for you, but everybody in your life and ultimately the entire world. So dedicate all of these efforts with like a fierce intent that everything you do in your life will never harm, but only bring the very best benefit. Dedicate that everything in your life becomes Dharma, taking the essence of this life. And dedicate that you can let your natural potential shine to enlighten yourself and all sentient beings just by your very presence on this planet. So thank you very much, everybody.